You are listening to the Buckeye Visualist, a podcast for members of the Ohio News Photographers Association.
Welcome to another episode of the Buckeye Visualist, a podcast for members of the Ohio News Photographers Association, supporting Ohio's professional and student visual storytellers. I am your host, Lori King, and I thank you for tuning in. Before I announce my next guest for this show, you have got to hear this. This is the sound of complete, unabashed, and sometimes hysterical fandom. That was a short clip extracted from Meg Vogel's compilation of Cincinnati Bengals fans celebrating the kick heard around the world. A part of the video even aired in Germany right before the Super Bowl. When I first viewed that video on Twitter, I knew I had to invite Meg to be on the show because it was a brilliant idea that spoke to a lot of Buckeyes, and I'm pretty sure you listeners would want to hear how she came up with that idea and how she produced it. For those of you who don't follow football and have no idea what I'm talking about, let me fill you in on this story for a second. The Cincinnati Bengals beat the Kansas City Chiefs 27-24 in a thrilling overtime victory. Evan McPherson kicked the field goal that advanced the Bengals to the Super Bowl for only the third time in franchise history. Sensing that fans probably went wild after Evan McPherson's game-winning field goal, Meg came up with the idea to string together videos of fans anticipating, reacting, and then celebrating that 31-yard field goal. But before we get into all of that, I want to formally introduce you to my next guest, Meg Vogel, a 2013 graduate from Ohio University School of Visual Communication and a longtime visual storyteller at her hometown newspaper, the Cincinnati Inquirer. Meg's accolades are pretty long, but I'll just highlight a few of her major accomplishments. Let's start off with the big one. She earned a Pulitzer Prize for local team reporting for the 31-minute documentary, 7 Days of Heroin. She's an ONPA POI winner of 2016, 2018, 2019, and 2020. And in 2018, was named one of the 30 under 30 top women photographers in the world. Her work focuses on socially aware stories, like the Sex Talk series about campus sexual assault, and Raising Zay, a compassionate story about the journey of 12-year-old Zay Crawford who felt trapped in the wrong body. She also volunteers as a visual storyteller for Save the Rain, a nonprofit that specializes in rainwater conservation. Okay, Meg, let's get back to that amazing video of tears, cheers, and beers, the Hooday fans video. What was the inspiration for that video?
Well, first, Lori, thank you so much for having me today and to talk about this video. I had no idea that it would be seen the number of times that it has been seen, and I had no idea that it would travel all over. You know, kind of going back to that Sunday and experiencing the elation that was going through Cincinnati, I was watching the game at home, and I recorded the end. I recorded the kick myself just because I wanted to preserve it. It felt like this moment. And Evan kicks, goes through. My neighborhood's putting off fireworks. And it was just like, there was this buzz. And I went downtown and tried to document what this felt like for the city. And people are throwing fireworks everywhere. They are dancing in the middle of the street. They're honking their horns. And I was just giddy. It was so exciting to see the city electric. And I started posting some videos onto Twitter of that, just that raw reaction. And as I'm scrolling through, I am seeing a lot of other reaction videos, people in their living rooms, people just screaming and jumping and hugging. And I was just so moved by that. There was a few friends of mine who also shared their videos, and I reached out to them and said, hey, do you think I could use them? I think I'm going to put something together. And I started thinking about it more and more. And I thought the easiest way of doing it was sending out a tweet. So Monday morning, I tweeted out to Bengals fans, hey, share your reaction videos. I want to work on something for the Enquirer. had no idea what it was going to look like. I just wanted to capture it and put all of these moments together. And so I sent the tweet out, and I'm not a big Twitter person. I'm not like great on Twitter. People aren't like, oh, let's go to Meg Vogel and see what she's thinking. So I don't have a huge following or anything, but some people started retweeting and I started getting responses, and they came in really fast. And within 36 hours, I had 300 videos. People started finding my personal email address, my phone number, my Instagram. I was getting videos from all over, and it was so exciting. It was cool to see people celebrate collective joy. And I think in the past, you know, couple of years, it's just been really hard. And it has been, you know, there's been so much division, and to see people come together in this one moment. And I thought, that's pretty special. How can I put everyone in the same living room experiencing the same moment all together forever? That's what I set out to do. So I just started getting a lot of videos. I had never done anything like this. I'll say when we do Enquirer submitted photos and videos from our readers, we don't usually get a big reaction or a big response. This was the opposite. We got such an overwhelming response. And I woke up on Tuesday morning and I had a video from a dad and daughter in Australia. And I was like, okay, we're on to something here. Like that is a very cool moment to have this joy, not just in the tri-state area, not just in the United States. It's going thousands of miles. So a couple of those key videos started coming in, and that's when I started forming a little bit more of the storyboard of what this could potentially look like.
So you said you collected over 300 videos. I actually saw that tweet that you put out asking for the videos. And then yes. It was so exciting. And I looked at a couple of them too, not knowing what it was to become.
Well, you know, Lori, that thread brought me so much joy. And I was sharing that, just the thread of tweets that people were responding, because it was moments from all over the place. And this one guy, he sent me a 25-minute clip of him watching the end of the game. And I was like, wow, I used a second and a half of it, but I did go through all 20 minutes. It was such a cool thing. And it was funny. I talked to my mom about it because she's like, I never would have thought to record myself. And I think this is kind of the beauty of this day and age, that everyone does have that camera in their pocket. And I had seen a few people record in the weeks prior to this, but not a lot. It was just this moment that everyone knew, if they're experiencing with their parents or their grandparents or their children, it was something they wanted to remember forever. So I was very lucky that so many people were recording. And since the video has published, I got a few hundred more after it. Hey, if you're doing a part two, you should add me in there. I was like, that is not in the plans, but thank you for reaching out.
When you started receiving these videos, did you start putting them in separate folders according to the anticipation and then the reaction? And, you know, like you lumped together people going out into the snow and doing snow angels and popping champagne. And how many of the videos did you use compared to how many you received?
So to answer your first part of your question, organization was key on this. It was essential because of the volume. And I also knew I had to get this video produced quickly. There wasn't going to be that appetite a week and a half later. There wasn't going to be, I was kind of racing against the clock a little bit because I wanted it produced as quickly as possible. I wanted to capitalize on this moment and make sure that like people were still interested in seeing the reaction videos, because when I was getting these responses on Monday, people were watching it and sharing it. And I was thinking on Tuesday, like, oh gosh, is it going to be too late? Is everyone over it? They were not. So as I was gathering them, I just put everything in one giant folder and then put everything on a timeline. And I watched scrub through every single clip of it. So as those patterns emerged of, are people drinking? Are people screaming? Are people hugging? Are people jumping in pools? Are they in snow? I then started clipping things out and putting it into these different buckets, essentially. And that's how that started to emerge. And when I was getting these responses, it was so important to me. I wanted to use as many of them as possible because I wanted everyone to feel part of it. And so I can't tell you how many, like the exact number, but I think it was about 85 to 90% of the videos I used. And you could see that in when you watch the video, there are a lot of grids where there's similar reactions and it's large groups of large groups of people. I wanted them to be part of it. Some clips, you know, people are sending in and they're like really low quality, or the audio was just really, really hot and I couldn't use it. Like if there wasn't a technical issue, I tried to put it in but there was just a lot.
What kind of software do you use to edit it?
I use Final Cut Pro to edit.
A lot of people aren't using Final Cut Pro anymore. A lot of people have went to like Adobe Premiere Pro.
Yes, a lot of people have moved on from Final Cut. That is part of my software that I have at the Enquirer, so that's what I use. I have not really experimented a lot with Premiere. I think that'll be something that we'll have to do because it's a part of our Adobe suite, but I'm using the software that I'm provided through work.
Okay. So the response to it has been, I'm sure, fantastic. I think given the fans of voice, there's no way that you as a photojournalist could be in the living rooms of all those people. And sometimes we just got to let them tell the story.
Yeah. And I think that's an important thing. You know, we are a staff of 8 photographers. We've got photographers, video producers, graphic animations. Like, we are a very strong and very nimble staff, but there is no way that we can cover all of these reactions. And I think that is such the beautiful thing about this is you are seeing such a raw, organic reaction. And we respond to that. I don't think it would have been as powerful if you saw it from 8 points of view. I think you needed that volume to feel it. And this is one of those videos that I, as a video editor and as someone who does enjoy like producing more documentary films, and I really focus on quality. This is so much more about the moment, and we will forgive some of the quality issues if it's audio, if it's, you know, the framing or whatever, because as humans, we are just so drawn to the emotion and the moment. And that was such a nice reminder for this, because sometimes I think as photographers, we get really stuck on making sure it's sweeping and beautiful and technically correct. And we forget the true essence of the story. And this is a raw, beautiful moment. And I think it's really neat. Kyle Robertson's son is in the video. He sent me a video of his son running out with a cowbell in a Bengals hat in his underwear. And it was perfect. It was such a nice moment to have in there, and how everyone reacted in such a different way. We could never have covered that variety and of reaction as a staff, and also cover the game.
It really was brilliant. I loved it. The ONPA contest is coming up. Are you going to enter that? And what other videos have you been working on in the past year that you are going to enter? I've wanted to talk to you for so long because of the videos that you win. I mean, you truly are a jewel for the state of Ohio for video storytelling.
Well, that's a very nice compliment.
That's true.
Well, thank you. It's funny, our Enquirer photo staff were just messaging about the deadline is next week. We are a little bit of a procrastinating photo staff. So I have it on my list to do. I have not done it. I'm sorry. Sorry, Josh. And, but I will do it for videos this year. You know, it's been such an interesting year because we're still in this pandemic, and so much of what makes a good video is time, like any photo story, and being in someone's home and spending that time with people. It's essential. So I've had to really be creative on how to do different stories. And one of the pieces that I'm really excited about that produced during the holidays was a piece about two pen pals, Doreen and Gary, who have been pen pals for over 80 years. And they started writing to each other when they were 10 years old. One was in Ohio and one was in Liverpool. And they wrote from 1939 and they still write today. And they wrote about their experiences as young girls during the war. They wrote about what it was like to be teenagers, what it was like to fall in love, what it was like to have a family. And they have had this friendship for decades and they have never met. They have never talked on the phone. And we heard from the woman here. She's in Northern Kentucky now. Her name is Gary. We heard from her daughter because they had not gotten a letter from Liverpool during the pandemic and they were worried that the pen pal had passed away. And they reached out to us to see if we could find out and look at obituaries. And then a letter arrived and it was just because of the pandemic has slowed down the mail. And we said, well, you know, we're happy to look at obituaries, but this is also a really fascinating story. And so we got to do this piece about friendship that spans a lifetime. And we actually got to connect the two women and they met for the first time. And it was a really lovely video. I think it was one of the most pure stories I have done in a long time that didn't involve a lot of sadness. And it was a real bright spot for me. So that's one of the pieces I'm really proud of from this past year. That's a little different and also requires the wonderful technology of Zoom and leaning into that a little bit more. I think we're able to broaden the stories we're able to tell.
Oh, Zoom is amazing. In fact, this isn't the first time that you've been my guest on a podcast.
That's true.
Way back in June of 2018, you and I and Carrie Cochran Skyped for an episode of The Voices of the Media, which was my first podcast show. We talked about your collaboration together to produce 7 Days of Heroin, which won the Pulitzer in April of 2018. How has life been for you after winning that grand prize?
You know, it's funny, Lori, I've never really been asked that question because I think so many people think you win that award and like this new golden, like it's like Wizard of Oz and you go from like black and white to Technicolor and you're in this like grand, it's like, oh, you're in this new place. And that's just not, life doesn't really change, you know? And that was such a team prize too, that it was so important that it was about our team and it was a newsroom effort. And I think it's so funny that the day after, you know, I'll be honest, we were all like a little hungover because we had a lot of champagne and I had an early morning assignment at City Hall. And I was there with Dan Horn, who was one of the lead writers, and Sherry Coolidge, who was another one of the writers who I worked with a lot during that week. And there we were covering City Hall. And it's like, okay, so that yesterday was great, but also we had to fill a paper today. Back to reality. I think the best thing about being on that stage and having a project be elevated in that way is that we were able to do a lot more newsroom-wide projects that took a lot of time because I think we built that trust, not even within our newsroom, but with USA Today and with our community. And I mean, I still hear from people in our community about it. I still work on projects and they will mention it, which is really wonderful. I was doing a piece this summer about vaccine hesitancy in Indiana and it came up and we were with one of their public health officials and like, it's been a few years. I can't believe you remember it, but that project helped them educate their EMS and their public health workers and help them provide more Narcan in their community. And so that was, it's always nice to hear those reactions to it, but no, it's, you know, we're still filling a paper and we still are telling stories and you're still covering City Hall. And it's great that there have been more opportunities to do bigger, richer stories since that project. But yeah, we're still a local newspaper.
Are you guys still publishing 7 days a week?
We are. We are until, well, I believe it's like next week is our last.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
Yeah, we are not going to be publishing on Saturdays.
Oh man. It begins. You know, the Toledo Blade's down to 2 days a week. We only publish on Thursdays and Sundays. In my lifetime, I never thought that would ever happen.
You know,
so now you're cutting out Saturdays.
We're cutting out Saturdays. I've heard from people and they're like disappointment. And just like you said, like, oh, and now it begins. I don't know. I don't see it that way. Yeah, it's disappointing that we're not able to provide 7 days a week, but we're still going to have a paper. We're still going to be producing stories. And I think because my work, I think it lives on such a digital space on our website, especially with the videos, I don't see our work going away. I don't see the stories disappearing. I would always love for our newsroom to be more robust, to have more of a coverage, but I'm really impressed by how, even though we have had a lot of cuts and how we have shrunk a lot since I started 7 years ago, we're still doing really good work and we're doing strong work. And I often get asked about it, like, oh, well, I went to speak at my high school and my old English teacher's like, oh, well, that newspaper is getting really thin. Oh, you guys are, and he used the word dying, which just really irritates me. And I said, well, do you subscribe? And he's like, oh, well, oh, and I was like, well,
that's
can't
why.
Complain if you're not subscribing. But, you know, I think it's easy to look at the weight of the paper. It's easy to look at certain things and think that we are struggling or think, but I look at the past couple of weeks with our coverage of the Super Bowl and the millions of people who went on our site and the millions of people who watched that video all over the world. And I always think there's going to be a place for what we do. It's going to look different. How we deliver it and how you interact with it is going to be different, but I always think there's going to be a place for it. So that gives me hope.
I took a couple classes at Wayne State that focuses on new media. So we're podcasting, TikToking. I'm having Andy Morrison come as a guest. He's going to fly his drone. Chris Post is going to be a guest speaker and he's going to be talking about virtual reality. So this, I think, is where we're going to go online.
Well, you know, Lori, I think about it is we have to meet our audience where they're at. And if we've got a generation who spends a lot of time on their phone, a lot of time on TikTok, why aren't we meeting them there? And it's great. We have got this team at USA Today who's just fantastic that they did the Wall, which also won a Pulitzer in 2017. And it was a full interactive VR experience of what the wall looks like between Texas and Mexico. And I found it just so fascinating and getting to actually step into, you know, into this and experience it. And the man who was really helped develop it, he was a game designer for EA Sports. And he's like, I never thought I'd work in journalism, but if we are able to put people closer to the story, make them feel it in a different way. I just, you know, you don't have to get ink on your fingers anymore to have that reaction. And I think that is so cool. And I think it opens up so many possibilities, especially for like what I love to do is these immersive video experiences. The Sex Talk was a 55-minute documentary, essentially that docuseries that took you through all these different questions and hearing these different reactions from people about certain topics like consent and sexual assault. We would never have that space in a newspaper to do that. We would never. And I think that's the cool thing is you open up so many more possibilities of space and you can think beyond just text and photos. I find it really exciting. I think it's an exciting time to be in news. I think it's an exciting time to move in these new directions and just experiment because who knows?
Yeah, this is the only way we're going to engage the younger generation for sure. I query all of the students on the first day of class and I ask them how many of you have read a newspaper and none of them do. None of them. So one of the assignments that I assign is, I call it legacy, the history of legacy journalism. Mm-hmm. And I force them to go out and buy a newspaper. And then they have to break it down into the elements of a newspaper. What's a byline? What's a flag? And really, a lot of those elements are being moved to online, like the dateline and the byline and the title of the newspaper. I mean, we're all still using those things, but now we can do pull out quotes, you know, in a website post. And
you can hear audio. I think there's something so powerful about hearing voices and hearing inflection and emotion. I'm so proud of R&R staff, Amanda Rossman and Amber Hunt and Amy Wilson, who have like pioneered this Accused podcast series, and they're in their fourth season. And it's so cool that they have like, they knew there was this space for like true crime reporting, but coming from this journalism, like deep journalism work. And they have spent so much time in producing these podcasts. And it's amazing that it has also opened up like this revenue stream for Gannett, and people are listening like in droves for this content. And I think that's really cool to think that a local newspaper, like this is the newspaper that I have read my entire life, is exploring those avenues. And I just think the possibilities are pretty endless.
What is your favorite topic to cover? It seems like you like digging into socially aware stories like the forgotten soldiers, school shooting survivors, COVID moms, saving wildlife. What drives you to give voice to your subjects?
I am driven to tell stories that focus on narrative and investigation and on people. I find people so fascinating, and I love that through my job, I get to meet so many different types of people and people who are really complicated. When I'm able to dive into a piece that isn't running in the paper the next day and get to spend time with people and get to see them in their environment and see them in their kitchen and at work and in their car, I feel like I start to really understand who they are and their motivations. And I think that's the best part of my job. And I have made a lot of connections in this community from, you know, I'm from here. And I don't think my curiosity of like our community is ever going to like run out. I find Cincinnati fascinating, and there's a rich history here and there's a complicated history. And I love that there's just so many people that have trusted me and the reporters I work with to be in their homes. And I think a big part of these stories that you've mentioned is it's a collaboration. It's a collaboration with reporters who I really trust and respect. And I can spend days reading transcripts and I can go through it as a reporter, because I think so many people think, oh, you're a photographer, or I hate hearing this, you're just a photographer. Oh, that's my photographer. I've never thought of myself that way. And I don't think anyone who's collaborated with me thinks of me that way. Is I am also a reporter. In interviews, I ask just as many questions as a reporter does. I like to figure out new ways of telling those stories as well. So right now I'm working on this piece about these three women who are refugees from Afghanistan. They are athletes and they had to flee. And this is a story that a reporter and I started working on back in January. And we thought, oh, like, let's do this, like, you know, three or four shoots and then we're done, you know, cause you kind of had to figure out timing wise. Cause again, we are a paper that we've got to file, and it's turned into a 6-week process. And I think more you get into these stories and figuring out the complications, and also understanding that you have to be thoughtful and you have to approach this as like, this is a piece that, it's not a one size fits all. We can't show faces. We can't show full faces. So like how this takes a little bit more care. And I like that challenge. I think some people would say, oh, let's just do a portrait. And it's like, no, there's other ways of telling it. And I'm so drawn to those stories that might take a little bit more time or might be a little bit more complicated. Cause I think in most cases, those are the pieces that really need to be told and need to be told now.
Let's talk about the balancing act of simultaneously shooting stills and video at the same time.
Don't do it.
Kyle and I had this conversation on the last episode as well. Tell us how you decide when you're going to shoot video and when you're going to shoot stills, and does one medium suffer over the other?
Absolutely.
It could be a big problem for photojournalists who have to do it all.
Yeah. And I have had to do it all for a long time, and I've gotten a lot better at making those choices. Cause I think early on, I wanted video. What if I'm shooting video of, I wanted stills of, and it's exhausting. I mean, it is a really hard thing to try and do both. I do both. I would set up a tripod and let the camera roll, and then I'd shoot stills and I'd get myself in the camera quite often. But what I'm trying to do and be better about now is determining what makes the most sense for the story. Does this need video? If it does need video, what does it need to tell a story? And I also like looking at that, is that going to mirror the written component? Is that going to mirror the photos? Because in a lot of ways you want something that is just telling it a little differently, because I want to be able to engage readers and have it be like, oh, this is new. This is something a little bit different. So it's a reward for that time, because you don't want to read a story and have a video do the exact same thing. You don't want a photo story to do the exact same thing. So that's a lot of the determinations are happening while we're planning a piece. And then when I'm actually producing and I'm in the field, I'm trying to think about more scenes. And when you're shooting a scene and it's just like a photo story, wide, medium, tight, what are these moments? What is this looking like? I don't shoot stills during that. I try and just focus on video and do one thing right. Because whenever I try and do both, neither of them work. So why waste the time? The longer I have on a piece, like weeks or months, I'm better able to juggle those. But if it's a piece that's like, it's a two shoot, I might do an interview and then one scene and then try and just focus on stills. Or I might skip video altogether because it's not necessary. I caution people from trying to do both actively at the same time. If you have a photo collaborator that you like to work with, do it together. I know staffs are small and we are all, time is very tricky, but if you're able to do it and you think it is worth the time, I think it's worth putting two people on it. So, because I think another part of this video conversation, and it's something that we have at the Enquirer, is, you know, it's great to be doing this video and it's great to be putting that effort in. And I find it really important. I think it's a great storytelling tool, but if you're not going to have it live on the website or be promoted and it's not going to be seen, then it could be a lot of wasted time. Because the video needs to be promoted in the same way that a story needs to be promoted. It needs to have the same real estate. As a newspaper, it's still a process to have video be a priority.
That's a good point. Can you share what's in your equipment bag? What's your go-to camera and light gear?
Oh, light gear. I don't use lights. just ask anyone on our photo staff. I get, I'm the natural light queen because lights are not my thing. I use a Canon 5D Mark IV and I have a 24-70 on that one. And then on my other hip, I've got the 1DX with a 135 F2. And that's what I shoot with. That's pretty much my standard. For video, we have a DJI gimbal called the Ronin that I use quite a bit. And then I just have like a mic system that I kind of set up. It's kind of like a Swiss Army knife situation for video. Cause I'm running audio. I've got a separate recorder to record the audio separately. And then I also have it on my camera, just for a backup. Then I do a two camera setup for interviews, two tripods. But yeah, that's pretty much my standard, is those two cameras with those two lenses. I don't do a lot of lighting. I can, but I just don't do a lot of it.
I had a basic LED light, model light that I would, you know, do a little bit of sidelining, but I'm not on tripod. That's about as far as I'd go. I'm a natural light person myself.
That's good to know, because a lot of people on our staff, like we've got, they just do such a beautiful job with lights and they'll set them up at restaurants. And here I am like, can I just put the burger on this like one spot on this table or by the floor? And I'm going to move this and trying to harness that natural light as best as I can. And like, even for video, I know there's a lot of complicated setups of like trying to, not complicated, but probably technically correct, of trying to get your key lights and trying to get all of that. I find it, if I can make it work in a situation, it's a lot better for intimacy and for having these conversations that usually for my projects, they are very intense and they're emotional. And I try and minimize my impact on that space as much as possible because I want people to feel comfortable. And so I try and minimize that as much as possible.
Do you ever think that you are going to get your drone's license? Is that inspiring to you at all to want to fly a drone?
Oh my goodness. I've been asking for 2 years. yes. I am in the works of doing that. We have not, through Gannett, have had a new training because of the pandemic, but that is one of my big goals for the year, because I would love to have my drone license.
You're going to love it. I got my drone license a year before I retired. You know, I retired in August. I don't know if you knew that.
I did.
But they were, and I talked with Kyle about this last time too, but there are times we just absolutely need a drone.
Yes.
Like one of the last times I used it was a big giant apartment fire where the entire roof was on fire. And there's no way that you can get the whole apartment complex and the scope of that fire without a drone going up in the air, or flooding. And there's so many good reasons to have it. FBI, where they keep us away back on the yellow line, but you can put drone up and you can, you know, shoot investigating scenes.
So we have 3 drone pilots on staff who are great. I call them the drone boys. And I'm always like, hey, can you drone this? And can you drone that? And because it is so essential for a lot of the stories I do, just for that sense of place. And it's just, it's a lot easier than trying to set up a lot of other things. And it's just, it's easier. And I think that's the cool thing also, is like drone technology is so much more affordable. Even doing video on DSLRs, like, that's so much more affordable than using cinematic cameras. And I think that's opening a lot of those possibilities for us. And even with, we did a documentary last year about the pandemic, and we followed different people and what they were experiencing. And we went through them. We followed them from like March until December. And it was amazing to have that drone also to show the emptiness and also the sense of time, because we'd have them drone in the winter, the spring, the summer, and then the fall. So you were able to see this passage of time in such an easy way. And I think it translates really beautifully, and it adds such a better like cinematic quality to the overall piece. And I'm really thankful that we have 3 licensed drone pilots on staff, but I would like to join them very soon.
Good luck with that. I cannot wait till you do. You've been with the Enquirer a few years. Any intentions to do something different someday? Or do you plan to retire from your first and only day job like I did? Well, the Army was my first day job, but the Blade was my first newspaper job. I know that's a tough question because you're still young.
Yeah. And it's something I think about a lot.
Young and talented.
Well, thank you, Lori.
I would hate to see Ohio lose you.
Oh, well, thank you. I like being a storyteller in Ohio. I really like representing the Midwest. I take a lot of pride in that. I really do. I love that when I'm out shooting something, I can start talking to someone, and 9 times out of 10, I'm going to know someone who's related to them. I'm going to know their neighbor, or I went to school with their sister or something like that. It's just, there's a tight knitness about this community that I love. Looking ahead, I have been at the paper for 7 years, and a lot of people have asked me, you know, what's next? What are you going to do? And I'm not really sure what the future holds. I know it will be centered around journalism and hopefully filmmaking and visuals. I mean, this is a world that I love. I never thought I'd be here this long. It's a place that really is, it just gets a hold of you. And I love what I've been able to do. And it's hard to kind of look forward, especially while we're still in a pandemic and while things just feel really uncertain. I'm not really sure exactly what the future will hold, but I know it will be still in this world of visual journalism and documentary filmmaking, because this is what I love to do. And it makes me so happy to be able to share these stories and to be a journalist. I just feel really lucky. And so whatever the future holds, I know those are the key elements of what I want to be doing.
Is there anything you would like the Buckeye Visualist listeners to know? Any tips, advice, encouragement?
So I mentor a few photojournalists, and I hear from a lot of students. And I think a podcast like this can just do so much for a student who, if they're at Kent or OU or UC or wherever, I think it's a powerful to know what this profession actually looks like. The day-to-day, when I graduated from OU, the dream is you get a job as a staff photographer, you're a photojournalist. And I was really lucky to get that opportunity very young. I was 23. And I remember kind of looking around like, okay, like I'm here, like what's next? I think it's important to appreciate this profession. I think this podcast would be very helpful for students who are learning photojournalism. I think it's really important to understand what this job is and what it looks like day to day, because when you're in school, it's like the goal is to be a staff photojournalist. And it is a very grueling profession. It is a very rewarding profession, but it is a really challenging job. And I remember being, you know, I got this job when I was 23 and I was kind of like, okay, I'm here. Like, you know, like what's next? And I don't know if I was like fully prepared for what this, like, this really looked like. And you throw yourself into every story and you give everything you've got, and there's not a lot left, you know, you burn out really quickly. It drains you emotionally. Covering the trauma and covering people's worst days of their life week after week really does take a toll on you. And I think it's important to recognize that earlier. And I'm so happy that there are conversations happening in classrooms right now about trauma and journalism. And if these last few years have not showed us anything, it's that we need to be having more of those conversations. So when you are looking or studying or interning and coming into photojournalism, I think it's important to talk to professionals about what this experience is really like and taking care of yourself and creating balance. Because I think a lot of students, and especially students who I've mentored or have asked me for portfolio reviews, they look at the awards and they look at these shiny moments of recognition. And that's not what this is about. You know, this job is hard. It is just, it's time consuming. And it is also one of the most rewarding things I've ever done, but it's so much about the people whose stories we tell. And it's easy to lose yourself in this job. As someone who has struggled in the last 2 years with being burnt out and being just exhausted from like covering a pandemic and covering protests and covering politics, you know, it's important to take care of yourself. And if you want to make this a sustainable career, you do have to take care of yourself, mentally, physically, and emotionally. And I think that's, you can't start doing that early enough. When you are a journalist, it's so much of who you are and how you treat people. And the better you are able to show up for people and be in their homes as your best self, like the better you're going to be able to tell that story. So yeah, take care of yourself.
On that note, thank you, Meg Vogel, for sharing your story. You have a gift for documenting humanity, which I think is at the core of who you are. I look forward to your stories for many years to come. To view Meg's Bengals fandom video and more of her award-winning still and video stories, go to her website at megvogel.com. I am your host, Lori King. Thank you for listening to the third episode of The Buckeye Visualist. Keep an F2.8 mind, everybody.
Listening to The Buckeye Visualist, an ONPA production.